joining us for our 2021 Annual Business Law Institute. It is important for us to uphold a Polsinelli tradition of providing an innovative CLE program to our clients, general counsel friends, and Polsinelli alumni. And given the circumstances, we are pleased to be able to do so again this year in a virtual setting. During today's webinar, you will be asked to answer two CLE polling questions. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer the polling questions. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours after the webinar to all those who answered the polling questions. CLE credit will not be available for on-demand viewing of this program. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If they are unable to answer during the live program, our speakers will connect with you via email after the program. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab. Please visit www.bli.polsinelli.com for additional information, including CLE application statuses, a detailed view of this year's schedule, and more. We look forward to connecting with you throughout the summer and coming back together in person next year. I'd now like to pass it over to my colleague to kick off today's program.
Hello, and good afternoon or good morning. My name is Mark Olthoff, and I am pleased on behalf of the Polsinelli Law Firm to welcome you to today's installment of the Business Law Institute, featuring speakers concerning class actions practice and the government investigations practice. The first half of today's program will discuss the class actions practice. At that point, we'll turn it over to our government investigations colleagues. I'm pleased to have with me today my colleague in Seattle, Aaron Wagner, who's a shareholder in our Seattle, Washington office. We are going to highlight today some recent developments in the class action law, as well as some hot areas involving class actions, and then conclude with a brief discussion about some areas that remain in dispute within the class actions area. It was recently reported in a survey of several hundred in-house counsel that the legal spend on class action claims and lawsuits reached nearly $3 billion, with a B, billion dollars in 2020. We foresee that this trend and these types of lawsuits are likely to continue to increase. Now, I'll turn it over to Aaron for a short introduction of himself and for his discussion.
Thanks, Mark, and good morning, everyone, or good afternoon. Of course, I'm in Seattle, so it's still the morning here, but as Mark said, my name is Aaron Wagner. I'm a shareholder in Seattle, but I also maintain a presence in our Atlanta office. A lot of my team is there. A large part of my practice is in the consumer protection class action space, with a concentration on TCPA, FCRA, and other alphabet soup statutes and state equivalent protection statutes. Handled a number of class actions for a number of various clients, and so today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some new developments in the class action space. As you can all guess, we've recently got our first CARES Act case in the Northern District of Illinois. We're handling that, but I'm going to talk more broadly about some of the developments that you may have seen. Some of you may be aware, or most of you probably are, that on April 1st of 2021, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Facebook versus Duguid. This opinion provided a uniform definition of what is an automatic telephone dialing system under the TCPA. An automatic telephone dialing system is commonly referred to as an ATDS. Duguid had sued Facebook alleging that its notification system violated the TCPA and that the equipment Facebook had used was an ATDS. The Supreme Court, though, held that to qualify as an ATDS, a device must have the capacity to either, one, store a telephone number using a random or sequential number generator, or two, produce a telephone number using a random or sequential number generator. This opinion reversed the Ninth Circuit, which had held that the capacity to store numbers and then dial automatically was sufficient to qualify as an ATDS, a very important distinction. In fact, Prior to Do Good, there was a circuit split over how to interpret the definition of an ATDS. Since the D.C. Circuit decided a case called ACA International back in 2018. The ACA International Court struck down the FCC's prior broad definition of an ATDS from 2015. So this issue had been litigated and relitigated for a while. The Third Circuit, along with the 7th and the 11th, had each held, in essence, that an ATDS required random or sequential number generation. On the other hand, the 2nd, 6th, and 9th held that a device need not generate random or sequential numbers as long as it had the capacity to store and automatically dial numbers. Of course, the district courts had tried to follow these various opinions. But the problem was with the broader definition of an ATDS is that arguably even smartphones had the capacity to store and automatically dial numbers. So just about any modern device could qualify as an ATDS. Ultimately, the Supreme Court went with a plain reading of the statute and opined that, and I quote, Duguid's quarrel is with Congress, which did not find an auto dialer as a valuably as he would have liked. This court must interpret what Congress wrote, end quote. I note that these cases are notably involve a lot of use of vernacular, sessant being one of my favorites. In remanding the case back to the Ninth Circuit for further proceedings, the court held that Facebook's notification system was not an autodialer because it neither stored nor produced numbers using a random or sequential number generator. This is an important decision, has broad sweeping impacts on this area of litigation, and so we'll see what happens in the lower courts in the months to come. Another important case I want to mention is the TransUnion LLC versus Ramirez. That's another case pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. At issue in this case is whether either Article 3 or Rule 23 permits a damages class action when the vast majority of the class suffered no actual injury, let alone an injury anything like what the class representative suffered. The decision has standing implications under Article 3 as well as typicality, adequacy, and predominance implications under Rule 23. The Supreme Court heard oral argument in this matter on March 30th. If you haven't listened to the argument, it's actually a very informative one, and so we'll keep an eye out for that decision to come down. On a related topic, another case that we want to discuss is the Olean Wholesale Grocery Coop versus Bumblebee Foods in 2021. In this case, the Ninth Circuit held that the district court abused its discretion by granting class certification without determining the percentage of class members actually injured by the alleged anti-competitive act or conduct in that case. When considering if the predominance element of Rule 23 has been met, the court held that a key factual determination must be whether the plaintiff's statistical evidence sweeps in uninjured class members. In the case, the Ninth Circuit ruled that although the court had established a threshold for how great a percentage of uninjured had not established a threshold for how great a percentage of uninjured class members would be enough to defeat predominance, the court ruled it must be de minimis, the reason being that where a proposed class contains a significant percentage of class members who have suffered no injury at all, then individual issues necessarily predominate over common issues. In that case, the plaintiff's expert had opined that 94% of the class would have sustained injuries by the defendant's conduct, but the defendant's rebuttal expert determined that 28% of the class would not have sustained an injury. The Ninth Circuit held that 28% would not meet any reasonable definition of de minimis, and by failing to resolve that issue of the percentage of class members who have actually been injured, the district court abused its discretion. Interestingly, in passing, the court noted that 5-6% had been found to constitute the outer limits of de minimis, although it didn't make that finding in this case. Instead, the Olean Wholesale opinion is helpful also because it does cite to some pretty helpful case law when trying to challenge class certification. For example, it cited to the In Re Rail Freight Fuel Surcharge Antitrust Litigation case, which can be found at 934 Federal 3rd, 619 from the D.C. Circuit in 2019. That court held that predominance is not satisfied where over 12% of the class members were not injured. And similarly, in the In Re Asical Antitrust Litigation, from the First Circuit in 2018, the court held that predominance is not satisfied with roughly 10% of class members were not injured. Another interesting word found in that case was econometrician, not one that you use daily, but in those types of cases, apparently they play a central role. Let's go to the next slide here. Just a few other mentions to some anticipated COVID-related class actions that we see coming down the pipe. Our folks are anticipating an influx of labor employment claims related to working from home issues, as you can imagine, off-the-clock claims and expense reimbursements. Similarly, we anticipate lawsuits from essential workers related to overtime, time off the clock, waiting for temperature scans, those types of things. We also expect to see challenges to employer-mandated vaccinations. And lastly, as workers are called back from furlough, I'm sure there will be employees who were not brought back alleging discrimination and how employees were selected to return or not to return. And so just a highlight of some new developments in this area and also kind of what we see coming down the pipeline. I also mentioned that we recently took over a CARES Act case involving the FCRA and credit reporting. So and we anticipate, you know, obviously we'll see these issues on the slide, but the CARES Act and those different types of things are certainly on the way. So subject to that, I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, Mark, who's going to talk a little bit more about what's hot and what is not in class actions.
Mark, you may be on mute.
Thank you so much, Aaron. I appreciate that. I now want to, let me first introduce myself. I mentioned my name previously, Mark Olthoff. I'm a shareholder in the Kansas City office in the commercial litigation practice, although the vast majority of my time is spent in the class actions area, defending companies on a variety of class action topics. I want to discuss with you a couple of class action areas that are very hot right now. Both of those relate to privacy claims and class actions. I'll start with a species of privacy litigation under the rubric of biometric privacy. For those of you who may be unfamiliar with biometric privacy, I'm generally referring to those aspects of human biology that can be collected and are unique to every individual, such as fingerprints, retinal scans, voice prints, facial recognition, and the like. These biometric identifiers can be very useful in the workplace for timekeeping, for example, clocking in and out, using point-of-sale machines, for security and other uses. However, given their personal nature, protecting that privacy is also important. I've identified on this slide a number of states that have actually adopted biometric privacy statutes, Illinois being one of the first and one that has one of the most impactful regulations because it includes both private rights of action and statutory damages. Texas and Washington also have robust statutes, but they can only be enforced through the Attorney General's office. I might also mention that a number of states have data breach privacy notification statutes, and biometric identifiers are being added to those in virtually every state at this point. I mentioned the Illinois statute because since January of 2019, there's been a virtual explosion of lawsuits, primarily class actions in that state. The lawsuits and claims have piled up probably literally over $1 billion, highlighted by a recent settlement involving Facebook that was over $650 million. I mentioned the Illinois statute has a fairly robust enforcement mechanism through private rights of action and penalties. But there are compliance requirements that, if met, would allow you to collect and disseminate biometric information. I've highlighted here with the bullet points the primary aspects of the statute requirements, which include notice before collection, a written or signed consent or release form from the person whose information is going to be collected, a written record of the company's record retention policy, and then obviously security of the information once it's collected. I'll note that Illinois this spring introduced legislation to perhaps curb some of the litigation that's been ongoing. The debate continues within the legislature about what the appropriate statute of limitations should be, whether the penalties should be reduced, and whether there should be a cure period once a company is on notice of that. Perhaps a recognition by the legislature that these lawsuits have gone too far. Again, something we'll continue to monitor, both in Illinois and other states that are looking at potential statutes regarding biometric privacy, including New York. The next slide, I highlight some of the key litigation issues that have developed in the state of Illinois. For one, the courts in Illinois have adopted a fairly lengthy statute of limitation for biometric privacy claims, 5 years. So even though the statute was rarely used prior to January of 2019, we're now 2+ years out from that, but the claims probably accrued back well before the explosion began. So we're continuing to see lawsuits in the biometric privacy area pile up in the state of Illinois under their statute. Many claims originally got filed in federal court or were removed to federal court. We're seeing a change in that because federal courts have rejected those claims on the basis of standing and either dismissed them or remanded them back to state court. So I think what we're seeing more and more frequently are claims made in state court, although the federal courts continue to debate whether standing exists under particular elements of the Illinois Biometric Privacy Act. Preemption is a key defense that was available in certain claims. Largely, those are related to union shops, and so there may be a preemption defense under the Labor Management Relations Act. Recently, just within the last couple of weeks, the Illinois Supreme Court answered a question concerning whether there is insurance coverage for BIPA claims in the state of Illinois. And while not necessarily breaking new ground in terms of its opinion with respect to coverage, it is one of the first, if not the very first, Illinois Supreme Court opinion that found and upheld the lower court's decision that there was insurance coverage under a general business liability policy. Two other points I'll mention just briefly before going on to the next slide, which are whether the Biometric Privacy Act in Illinois is applicable to non-Illinois residents. That is, does it have extraterritorial effect? So if you have a company that is sued outside the state of Illinois by non-Illinois residents, or somebody in Illinois but suing a non-Illinois defendant, could you bring that case in other states? So I think there's continues to be debate whether there is extraterritorial effect. And finally, just notably here, because technology changes every day, as we know, so the impact of that technology on the collection, distribution, or security of biometric identifiers will continue to be something that is litigated in these cases. The next area that I want to talk to you about in privacy litigation is more generally referred to as cyber attacks, data breaches, data losses, and more recently, as noted in the papers and in the press, ransomware attacks. We've seen a number of states rushing in to adopt privacy legislation, one of the more recent ones being California, whose statute went into effect a little over a year ago. Virginia recently adopted a new statute that will go into effect in a couple of years. many, many other states are also looking at increasing the legislative oversight in data protection. And some of those statutes will include private rights of action, some do not. And so it's going to be important for those of us here at the firm and elsewhere to be aware of what any particular state might require in terms of privacy protections and what will be required for in regulations of the, under those statutes. There also has been from time to time an effort in Congress to legislate nationally with respect to a federal privacy law. It's unclear whether that statute or that legislation will have legs given the distinctions between the House and the Senate with respect to majorities, but that is something that will continue, I think, to be introduced over time. The last bullet point highlights that much like claims under the Illinois Biometric Privacy Act, we've seen an explosion of more general privacy lawsuits. Claims typically involve claims against companies that have had their data breached through a hack, through a phishing expedition of some sort, that you get a phishing email, or just a loss of data in other respects. In some instances, those data losses have to be reported to regulators, and plaintiffs' firms have found that there's a way to identify those reports to the regulators, and they follow those with lawsuits. Typical claims, as I mentioned, involve negligence, breach of contract, express or implied, invasion of privacy, tort claims, unjust enrichment, or in particular instances, claims under state consumer statutes. I've identified a number of areas where we've seen these data breach claims and privacy lawsuits. So again, something I think for everybody to understand and be aware that, that those are continuing to be hot areas. Lastly, under this topic of privacy litigation, I just wanted to touch on what are some of the typical costs involved with data breaches. And I won't go through each and every one of these, as you can read them yourselves, but I want to highlight probably a couple of them. And two of them are the loss of profitability, distraction, and opportunity costs. And really what's involved there is simply business disruption. When these things occur, it's going to take personnel time, going to take an effort to work with regulators, and if a lawsuit's been filed with lawyers. So there are opportunities there that will be lost with data breaches. The other one I wanted to point out is with ransomware payments. Recently, we know of the Colonial Pipeline ransomware payment, as well as a week or so ago, the JBS meat processing one. JBS was roughly $11 million, as it's been reported. So these are serious, and they need attention, and they oftentimes need attention immediately. So incident response is vitally important. And something that I'm sure will continue to be important throughout. I think we're now at a point in time where I'm going to hand it back to our host for the first polling question.
Great. Thank you, Mark. This is the first CLE polling question for today's program. You must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the polling question in the slides box. Although recent developments have shifted the landscape in some federal court cases, class actions in state court are likely to continue to increase. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your internet browser and hit submit. Again, although recent developments have shifted the landscape in some federal court cases, class actions in state court are likely to continue to increase. Please select true or false. Hit the submit button in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If you continue to have any issues submitting, please email events@pulsinelli.com.
Again, that's events@pulsinelli.com. I'm going to give you guys about another minute to answer. Again, any issues with answering the polling question, try refreshing your internet browser, select your answer, and hit submit in the lower right-hand corner. And if it continues, please email events@pulsinelli.com. I'm going to give you guys another 10 seconds. All right. Thank you guys so much. Mark, I'll pass it back to you.
All right. Thank you very much. And so finally, we'll conclude here with a couple of slides. And so I don't intrude too much longer on my colleagues' discussion and government investigations. I'll go through these somewhat quickly. But these are areas of class actions that have had some mixed results in terms of their effective use or applications. The first bullet point refers to, at least in the antitrust area, potential for set-aside motions that have been filed by plaintiffs' lawyers to set aside certain amounts of money for opt-out plaintiffs or to cover their attorney's fees. At least in this case here, the generic pharmaceuticals pricing antitrust matter, the court rejected an effort to set aside a portion of the judgment or settlement. In large part because the motion was filed prior to certification and the court did not have enough information about whether that sort of a set-aside could occur. But based upon what's likely to occur in the future, that may not be a successful strategy if you're the plaintiff in a case to set aside funds for potential opt-out plaintiffs. The next case, the Olean case, Aaron addressed that very well. And I think the only thing I would highlight is to follow up on what he said concerning the existence of uninjured putative class members. And courts, I think, we're going to be looking at whether certification can be accomplished or whether it should be appropriate where there are a large number or significant number of uninjured class members, and probably would apply not only in antitrust cases but likely to apply in privacy cases in the future as well. The other two items, I won't touch on them other than to say there are circuit splits on each of those two bullet points with respect to incentive awards and ascertainability. In light of the fact that there are circuit splits, it would not be surprising as those cases percolate in the lower district courts and ultimately elevate up to the circuit courts that will see an appeal up to the Supreme Court through writ of certiorari. But again, those are significant matters in class actions. That concludes our presentation. I want to thank Aaron and the rest of my team who helped put these slides together. And now I'll turn it over to Ellen Persons to get started on the government investigation segment.
Thanks so much, Mark and Aaron. Pleasure to be here. My name is Ellen Persons, and I'm a shareholder in our government investigations group out of the Atlanta office. I was formerly an assistant U.S. attorney before joining Pulcinelli, and I'm joined today with my colleagues Jessica Andrade, who is also a former assistant U.S. attorney and now a shareholder out of our Seattle office, and the co-chair of our government investigations group and a former prosecutor, Melissa Ho, who is out of our Phoenix, Arizona office. And I could talk a lot more about them, but we need to get going. So we are going to be covering some of the fraud that has arisen as a result of COVID and what the government is focusing on as a result of that fraud, specifically the CARES Act loan fraud that we're seeing, COVID counterfeiting and fake PPE and other scams, and unemployment insurance fraud. We'll start with the CARES Act loan fraud. In passing the CARES Act, which is the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, and related legislation back in March of 2020, Congress provided for several different types of emergency pandemic relief that was to be administered by the Small Business Administration and other federal agencies. And that included the PPP, which is the Paycheck Protection Program that you've probably heard of, to assist certain businesses so that they could continue paying workers during this difficult time. And additionally, the Economic Injury Disaster Loans, or EIDL as we'll refer to them. And those are loans that were offered through the Small Business Association to offset financial difficulties that were caused by the pandemic. Of the more than $2 trillion that have been authorized under the CARES Act during 2020, over $500 billion of that was allocated to the PPP loans. There have been several. What's interesting is the first round that was funded with $349 billion was exhausted in only 13 days. There have been several additional rounds of funding, and in fact, this last round ran out before the May 31st, 2021 application deadline. These numbers are, of course, staggering and remind us of the substantial amount of federal dollars that were spent in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Something to keep in mind is many of these loans are forgivable in the event that participants in the programs comply with the rules involving how the loans are used and related business operations, such as keeping employees on payroll. And these programs are focused on keeping smaller businesses and their employees afloat. And the loan statistics reflect that very goal. The average PPP loan size has been just under $60,000, and more than 90% of the PPP loans have been for $150,000 or less. Similarly, the average EIDL loan size has been just over $50,000. And something to keep in mind is the hundreds of billions of dollars in disaster assistance program loans through the SBA. This exceeds all assistance lending since 1953. So these numbers truly are staggering. So what are some of the sources of fraud? Well, shortly after Congress passed the CARES Act in March of 2020, the DOJ's criminal division moved pretty quickly to start addressing the fraud that popped up, particularly related to the Paycheck Protection Program. The fraud section specifically set up a team that was devoted to focusing on PPP fraud, and within 2 short months, they had already charged several individuals. Now, the allegations in the CARES Act fraud cases that have come out involve two different types of conduct. You have fraudulent representations in the application for the relief funding, and then fraudulent use of the relief proceeds that were awarded. The types of fraudulent representations at issue include things like applying when you're not even eligible for the relief, falsifying business, employee, and tax records, and false certifications about criminal records and other uses. On the fraudulent use side, in those cases, most that have been brought to date involve how the funds are being diverted for personal expenses. Some of you may have seen the cases out there about people using the PPP funds that they were awarded to go buy luxury cars or expensive houses, jewelry, paying off student loans, et cetera, which is clearly not what those funds are meant for. The dollars spent under the CARES Act are staggering, and unfortunately, the initial estimates suggest that $84 billion of that is potentially fraudulent lending. More than 30 agencies are involved in investigating this fraud, including the creation of 2 new entities. There's the Special Inspector General for Pandemic Recovery that's part of the Treasury Department that has been created, and the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, which is an interagency committee of inspector generals. These agencies have worked to charge 474 defendants with criminal offenses relating to $569 million in fraudulently obtained funds. And we believe this is only the beginning. We can look back at how DOJ responded to the TARP program that was created in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. And the similarities between TARP and PPP are pretty unmistakable. They were both made significant amount of money available in response to a crisis that our country was facing. They both came from quickly drafted legislation. They involve a robust oversight framework that only got up and running as the programs launched, so there wasn't a whole lot of lead time. And as we recall, as you may recall, the multi-year process of tracking down fraudulently obtained TARP funds suggests that the DOJ has just only begun to scratch the surface of what fraud there is in the CARES Act, and we will be seeing quite a bit of CARES Act fraud enforcement. And with that, I'm now going to turn it over to my colleague, Jessica Andrade, to discuss how what we have seen thus far, as I said, is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we can expect to see going forward from the Department of Justice. Jessica?
Thanks, Ellen. Hi, everyone. Good morning or good afternoon. So as Ellen mentioned, as we move into 2021, we have every reason to believe that DOJ will increase prosecutions of CARES fraud. And this is a little roadmap slide for you here of the different reasons that we think those prosecutions are on the uptick, such as Ellen mentioned, the volume in lending, increase in complaints, upcoming deadlines for loan forgiveness and audits, as well as the False Claims Act enforcement and the new administration. So let's walk through these elements. So as Ellen mentioned, the second round of Paycheck Protection Program lending funded by the late 2020 COVID relief bill opened up in January of this year and closed far ahead of schedule. So all the dollars are spoken for, though applications are still being processed, but not accepted at this time. And already in 2021, judging by what has been approved, and this is SBA reporting here, almost $7 million has been officially approved, which is much more than was approved in 2020, by the same time. So that's just in the first few months of lending. Notably, more loans are being approved in 2021, but the average loan is smaller. So during the first 3 months of the program, the average loan was about $107,000. Now, the average loan is half of that, or $53,000. So, already we're seeing whistleblowing and complaint spikes. So, there have been over 1.3 million referrals of allegations of fraud regarding the Small Business Administration's EIDL loan program. Financial institutions who must file suspicious activity reports whenever there is a suspected case of money laundering or fraud have filed over 40,000 of those reports with regard to PPP and EIDL fraud. The SBA is literally buried in complaints. So while there's no question we will see further enforcement this year, there is some question of when the SBA will get to investigating all of the complaints. So we're gonna see activity based on pandemic response funding for years. And as the Inspector General for SBA, who's responsible for these investigations, has said, we'll see investigations for the next decade. So upcoming loan reviews, we feel, are also going to trigger some investigations. There's applications for PPP loan forgiveness, which are due in early 2022. And for those applications, recipients must submit documentation to show how the funds were used, and then SBA will review it. The submission of data and review provides just another opportunity to generate investigations and to identify fraud. In addition, SBA has to automatically audit all PPP loans that are over $2 million, and those audits are ongoing now. So just the idea of audit has prompted some of the recipients of these loans to repay them. So they're choosing to return the money rather than face a government audit that could expose the company to discovery issues. So as these automatic checks on the PPP process move forward, we can expect more fraud cases. Now, the False Claims Act is also going to trigger some enforcement activity here. The False Claims Act is the main statute the government uses to prosecute fraud. It allows the government to recover potentially treble damages and penalties from companies or individuals that submit false claims to the government, which could be in the context of PPP or EIDL loans. While whistleblower SBA cases are filed under seal, so that has an interesting impact here, where the cases may already be filed at this point, but may become becoming public soon as DOJ investigates them and becomes ready to investigate those on an overt rather than a covert basis. And while there have been many criminal prosecutions of PPP fraud that we've seen in the news, and those are those Lamborghini cases where people are buying the luxury cars with PPP loans, like Ellen mentioned, we're starting to see civil cases as well. So the Sidebelt case on this slide is one of the first False Claims Act civil settlements for PPP fraud. And the background of that case is in April 2020, while Sidebelt was a debtor in bankruptcy, it submitted two PPP loan applications. And those applications falsely stated that it was not presently involved in any bankruptcy. And Sidebelt shopped the applications around and eventually were approved for $350,000 in loans. Then on April 22nd, 2020, just the day after the bank distributed the loan proceeds to Sidebelt, the president and CEO told the bank that they may not have answered that question regarding being bankruptcy correctly since they were filling out the application so quickly. And then in July, the company actually returned the full value of the loan. But that, you know, wasn't enough for DOJ, and they continued to prosecute and investigate Sidebelt. So really, this is an example of where a company is moving fast and quick in the context of the pandemic and ran into some trouble. Some other notable things about this case are, one, it's settled on an ability to pay basis, meaning that the damages for Sidebelt could have been much higher, but that since the company was in bankruptcy, DOJ likely settled for much less than they could have obtained. So the number could have been much worse here. And two, it involves the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act, or FIREA. So FIREA is a set of regulatory changes to the U.S. savings and loan banking system and the real estate appraisal industry, passed way back in the 80s in response to a savings and loan crisis. The FIREA is interesting because it authorizes DOJ to bring a complaint seeking civil monetary penalties against persons who violate one or more of several criminal statutes that involve or affect financial institutions and government agencies. So given the necessary involvement of banks in administering the PPP program, we can expect the False Claims Act to be used hand-in-hand with FIREA in a lot of these upcoming investigations and prosecutions. And FIREA is actually broader in scope than the False Claims Act. The False Claims Act is generally limited to circumstances in which the U.S. suffers a pecuniary loss as a result of a fraud. But in comparison, FIREA allows DOJ to pursue civil monetary penalties for any frauds involving or affecting certain types of financial institutions. So the U.S. itself doesn't actually have to experience a loss. So I think it's something that folks should be thinking about as these prosecutions increase. So another reason we feel fraud prosecutions will go up is the new administration. I mean, generally, the former administration, the current, both will say the same thing about prosecuting fraud, that it's a priority. It's not necessarily a partisan issue. However, when he was a senator, President Biden supported the 1986 amendments to the False Claims Act, which significantly expanded the role of whistleblowers, increased financial incentives, and reduced a number of critical barriers to SBA claims. And then again, Biden was vice president when the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act was passed in 2009. And that act expanded the False Claims Act enforcement tools for DOJ, including liability for knowing receipt of overpayments, not just liability for false claim submissions, and then expanded the statute of limitation for such claims. And then even the Vice President, Harris, she has her own history of landmark False Claims Act enforcement as Attorney General of California, which has an SBA statute that's modeled after the federal vision. So you can see that fraud enforcement is front of mind for folks in the current administration. And finally, new Attorney General Merrick Garland also has a long history of supporting the False Claims Act. As a judge, he wrote a dissent in the case where False Claims Act claim was rejected because the claim was not submitted directly to the government, but to a government grantee. Those FERA amendments I just mentioned amended the False Claims Act to bring in line with then-Judge Garland's thinking. And Xavier Becerra, the new Secretary of the Health and Human Services Administration, an agency which we know is on the receiving end of much of the FDA recoveries in the healthcare space, supported legislation in California to expand that state's False Claims Act whistleblower provisions. Another impact on increased prosecution is that as Congress has continued to pass legislation to fund recovery, they've also included provisions to combat fraud. So the American Rescue Plan Act provides funding to help states, counties, cities, and tribal governments even recover economic harm from the COVID-19 pandemic, but also includes nearly $150 million to combat fraud. The CORE Act that is pending in the Senate includes multiple oversight provisions. It gives greater jurisdiction and subpoena power to the Congressional Oversight Commission created by the CARES Act. It strengthens whistleblower protections and proposes a new direct channel for whistleblower complaints. So these provisions will also no doubt bolster False Claims Act investigations. And then finally, DOJ is also on a hiring spree. They started a task force, and they are hiring multiple attorneys whose jobs will be devoted solely to prosecuting CARES Act fraud over the next few years. These attorneys will no doubt be devoted to resolving hundreds of fraud cases currently open, as well as additional cases that will be coming up in the next few years. And now I will pass it to Ashley for our next poll.
Great. Thank you so much. Everyone, this is your final CLE polling question for today's program. Again, you must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the question in the slides box. Are all PPP loans automatically audited by the SBA? Please select yes or no and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your internet browser to submit. Again, are all PPP loans automatically audited by the SBA? Select yes or no and hit submit in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. Again, any issues that you may have with submitting, please email events@pulsinelli.com. Again, events@pulsinelli.com. I'll give you guys about another minute to answer. If you're not seeing the question in the slides box, please refresh your internet browser and try again. Again, this is your final CLE polling question for today's program. Give you guys another 15 seconds. All right, great. Well, I'm going to go ahead and pass it over to Melissa. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ashley. I'd like to talk about future areas of enforcement, lender liability, multiple dipping, and Bank Secrecy Act. Starting with lender liability, what's been really interesting so far is that despite lenders being allowed to rely on the representations of applicants, the lenders themselves have not been subject yet to prosecution. We believe, however, that if you're projecting out, the reality is even if they're not subject to prosecution, they are going to be subject to numerous subpoenas, numerous government investigations. It's going to be very costly for them. And in fact, I think some entrepreneurial insurance companies have predicted that, and some of them very creatively offered an insurance product so that people could buy coverage ahead of time as it relates to liability for underwriting and providing these PPP loans. The reminder is that under False Claims Act liability, liability extends to anyone who knowingly causes to be presented a fraudulent claim. So you can see future instances where perhaps a PPP lender did not have proper controls in place and Some of their employees did a wink, wink, nod, nod and helped a bunch of friends or family members fraudulently, and perhaps in the future they will be subject to liability for failure to supervise or not putting proper controls in place. As Ellen mentioned in her presentation, the creation of SIGPR is significant. It was created to safeguard the CARES Act funds and programs, and SIGPR has really identified their areas of concern, which consider multiple dipping as a large area of investigation, as well as Bank Secrecy Act reporting. Under multiple dipping, the theory is that no individual or entity should receive money from the federal government twice for the same purpose. That is very fact intensive. Borrowers can, in some instances, apply for multiple loans and do so for different purposes, but I think a lot of time will and resources will have to be invested to shore that up. And so we're not seeing a ton of these prosecutions yet, although we think that as the low-hanging fruit prosecutions continue and get resolved, the multiple dipping cases will come up. My favorite, of course, is Bank Secrecy Act reporting, a reminder of what CTRs and SARs are. CTRs are currency transaction reports. So these are the reports that financial institutions file for transactions above, the magic number of 10,000. A lot of people have heard about, if the magic cutoff is 10,000, so if I do transactions under 10,000, perhaps my bank does not have to report on me. That is absolutely false. It can lead to potential liability for money structuring and money laundering because of the existence of SARs, which are suspicious activity reports. That is where the financial institution fills out a form that it says, I believe this particular customer is behaving suspiciously. And there's no huge guideline for that. It's a very subjective type of inquiry, and they just fill out reports. This guy comes in and deposits money every Tuesday, and for some reason it's every Tuesday, and he's holding an ice cream cone, and I think he looks funny, so I'm going to file a suspicious activity report. Regardless if a CTR or an SAR is filed, we know that the government reviews these as a starting point. Oftentimes referrals come from CTRs and SARs, and we believe that, again, financial institutions who want to be compliant with their obligations will, encourage their employees to file as many of these as possible, and it's an area ripe for, I think, auditing and review. Let's talk about the CARES Act fraud case outcomes. Dozens of cases have settled across the country so far. As Ellen mentioned, the numbers as of late March, and we don't have the newest numbers as of this summer yet, but as of late March, we're talking about, over 500 people charged with, $569 million or so in fraud. The fraud section has taken on the bulk of these prosecutions and have recovered a lot of money in forfeitures. And I would say that, right now we're still looking at the prosecution of what we call low-hanging fruit. These are the people who were very obvious in their fraud. And so what happens is the government identifies these individuals, and they tend to get charged with conspiracy, wire fraud, mail fraud, bank fraud, theft of government property, false statements. I mean, what we call the grab bag of, general fraud claims that the government files. And what has, in fact, happened is that I think individuals have not wanted to go to trial, and they've wanted to plea because they've sort of, understood that the case against them was very strong, and we have not seen a lot of trials. There is one exception to this that I found recently that is very interesting. It came from the Middle District of Florida. A matter actually went to trial, U.S. versus Casey David Crowther. The reason why this case is noteworthy, not because he went to trial and was convicted. It's noteworthy because I think the reason he went to trial was this was an instance where he took out $21 million in loans. Of course, went out and bought a boat, which we find is a very common, act by some of these people who receive loans. He buys a giant luxury boat, and the government is not happy with him. He is a owner of a roofing business, not sure why he needed a boat. But the important part here is that the bank in question, in this case, that actually underwrote and gave him the loan and helped facilitate the loan, I should say, the bank did not consider themselves a victim because the bank took the position the loan was still a performing loan. So where's the fraud? Where's the loss? Went to trial, and he was still convicted. So it's an interesting a situation where you actually have a bank saying that they didn't feel like it was a fraudulent matter at all, that they were swept up into this, and the man was still convicted. Let me give you a sense of fraud sentencing. People have, oftentimes will ask, hey, how much money does someone defraud and end up being sentenced? There's no guideline or a rule for this. Obviously, the higher amount taken out, the more likely they are to spend time in custody. The most recent case that I've seen came out, again, the Southern District of Florida in middle of May, where a man received 6 years in prison for about a $4 million fraud. Certainly the type of fraud involved, the types of charges involved, the loss amount, and how egregious the conduct, all of that contributes to the sentencing, review that the judge must impose and take into account. Real quickly, there are lots of types of new counterfeit products and services that the government is looking at where people have come up with creative ways to defraud the public with respect to testing, vaccines, and PPE. The only thing I'll really mention about this that I found interesting is the impact of consumer fraud, which is you see the increase of fraud year over year. I would also mention that there are a number of civil actions and class actions filed on behalf of people who brought counterfeit masks, and certain IP holders such as 3M are working very hard to protect their intellectual property and have brought a lot of suit against false products on the market. Quickly, I will turn it over to Jessica to wrap us up.
Actually, it's Ellen. Thanks, Melissa.
Or Ellen. Sorry, Ellen.
No worries. As you can see, there's a lot of fraud involved, including unemployment insurance fraud. Not surprisingly, because of COVID, there's been more than $860 billion in federal funds appropriated for unemployment insurance benefits, and this includes unemployment insurance, pandemic unemployment assistance, and federal pandemic unemployment compensation to help supplement unemployment benefits. The next slide, you can just see how it spiked as a result of the pandemic, and this is in the billions of dollars. Sadly, these benefits that are offered to help individuals offset loss of work has caused fraudsters to target this. Early investigation and analysis indicates that international organized crime groups are targeting these funds by using stolen identities. Also, domestic fraudsters are doing this, identity thieves, prison inmates are using it to commit fraud. And, this is the beginning, and so there's a task force that was created last month, so we're probably going to start getting some actual statistics around this. You can see, Ohio says that fraudulent unemployment claims are currently three times more common than in the beginning of the pandemic. Approximately $63 billion in improper payments have been doled out since last year, and much of it is fraudulent, according to estimates we got from February from a watchdog for the U.S. Department of Labor. And individual states are estimating that billions of dollars of fraudulent payments have been made. And so the overall scope of the fraud in this area is really unknown and ongoing at this point. You should know that the Department of Justice has created a National Unemployment Insurance Fraud Task Force to go after this, and additionally, as Jessica mentioned, they are hiring assistant U.S. attorneys in multiple offices who are going to focus on this type of fraud, and there have already been some cases involving this, but the key takeaway is that current criminal fraud enforcement cases are just the tip of the iceberg in the CARES loan fraud. And we expect this to increase and remain strong in the future. And civil cases are expected to be sort of the next wave of enforcement that we see. And similarly, consumer and unemployment insurance fraud which has impacted millions of Americans and costs, they've exceeded the tens of billions of dollars. So there's lots of fraud out there. It's going to be costly, and the government will be investigating all of this, and it's not going to slow down anytime soon. So with that, I'll wrap it up, and thanks everything, and back to you, Ashley.
Great. Thank you guys so much. This does conclude today's webinar. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours directly to all who answered the polling questions. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on the BLI website within 48 hours. CLE credit will not be available for on-demand viewings of this program. Thank you all for your participation.